Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Clearly, there's a major trend in systemic management of breast cancer towards the use of tissue markers to predict the need for and response to systemic therapy. I met with Dr. Edith Perez for her take on the rapid evolution of this treatment strategy and for an update on clinical trials evaluating adjuvant trastuzumab. Dr. Perez began our conversation by commenting on predictors of response to endocrine therapy.
First of all, there are some translational data that have been released over the last year that really have implications for practice that we need to start thinking about. One of them is really the lack of value of paying too much attention to progesterone receptor status related to the benefit of aromatase inhibitors. Because there was a lot of confusion that was raised when the initial data from ATAC were reported based on local testing for estrogen progesterone receptor. And now that there has been central testing for ERPR with data presented at the San Antonio meeting in 2006, the so-called trans-ATAC, which is the translational aspect of ATAC, demonstrating that patients benefit from anastrozole independent of whether the PR is positive or negative. And these data are consistent with the data from the other aromatase inhibitor studies. So that should help clinicians be confident related to the use of aromatase inhibitors independent of the progesterone receptor status, as long as the estrogen receptor is positive. So that thing is very important for consideration. That's one area. The second area related also to testing in the setting of aromatase inhibitors is HER2, because many people felt that aromatase inhibitors just kind of worked only on HER2 positive. But now we have data also presented at San Antonio and at ASCO demonstrating that aromatase inhibitors benefit both HER2 positive and HER2 negative patients.
I guess one of the things that I have heard more about is the question of how effective is hormonal therapy in the patient with a HER2 positive tumor, particularly in view of the tandem data. Any comment on that or what your thoughts are about it?
Yeah, the data are actually disappointing related to the benefit of aromatase inhibitors alone or even aromatase inhibitors in combination with trastuzumab for these patients. We've known from preclinical modeling that these HER2 positive tumors are aggressive. They tend to have a fast growth rate. So if we think about that, then it's logical to say, okay, hormonal therapy is not going to work well alone. These tumors really require more aggressive treatment with chemotherapy and trastuzumab, and in the future, potentially lapatinib. So these data are surprising, but not really surprising. However, the data from Tandem, as well as the data from a small phase 2 study of letrozole plus trastuzumab, are consistent enough that I've actually changed my practice, because before this data became available, if someone asked me, Edith, what is your management of a patient with estrogen receptor positive, HER2 positive breast cancer? It really had been an aromatase inhibitor.
Now that's in the metastatic setting?
In the metastatic setting.
Right.
For premenopausal women, we have always recommended tamoxifen. But now that these data are available, certainly trastuzumab adds to the benefit of the anastrozole in a statistically significant way, something that we cannot overlook. But I believe, based on this data, that the patients with HER2-positive breast cancer are patients with such aggressive disease that they should be treated with chemotherapy in combination with trastuzumab upfront.
Even if they're asymptomatic?
Well, that is in general terms. For a patient with metastatic, symptomatic, HER2-positive, ER-positive breast cancer, we should not rely on hormonal therapy alone or even hormonal therapy and trastuzumab based on really the 21% response rate and the median time to progression of less than 6 months.
Can you just sort of backtrack a little and explain what Tandem looked at and what they saw?
Good. Yeah. The Tandem trial was a trial of about 200 women. Women could have received adjuvant tamoxifen, but their randomization was to anastrozole versus anastrozole in combination with the standard trastuzumab on a weekly regimen. If patients had been assigned to anastrozole and they developed progressive disease, they had the option of being moved to receive trastuzumab. So there was a crossover allowed, and ultimately 70% of the patients crossed over at the time the data were presented by Bella Kaufman at the ESMO meeting in October and also updated at the San Antonio meeting. What the study demonstrated is that the response rate for anastrozole alone was 7%. The objective response rate for the combination of anastrozole in combination with trastuzumab was really 20%. The median time to progression was in the range of about 3 months for anastrozole and in the range of a little more than 5 months for the combination of anastrozole in combination with trastuzumab.
Now, has anybody actually just looked at what the usual time to progression is if you give an AI to a woman with a HER2-positive tumor?
No, I mean, this is really the first large study that has looked at this issue, because what we had before were data from very elegantly conducted trials of hundreds of women with ER-positive breast cancer, but that had not been evaluated for HER2, demonstrating response rates in the range of 30%, progression-free survival or time to progression in the range of about 10 months.
Because, I mean, obviously there's a ton of data out there in the trials, but I guess you're saying most of those women didn't have HER2 assays, or you don't have the data on HER2.
That is right. And I suspect that in those trials that even more than 80% of the patients had HER2-negative breast cancer, because patients with HER2-positive disease really tend to present with more aggressive disease, visceral involvement, and rapidly progressive symptoms. So you see, and that's why we may have been a little bit skewed in our presumption that aromatase inhibitors were going to work very well in the setting of HER2-positive disease.
You know, you said that your practice has now changed, or you're much more concerned, it sounds like, about these women when they present or when they have metastatic disease. But, I mean, this is only one trial and not a gigantic study. I mean, do you think there could be something about the way the trial was done that would explain why they saw these results?
I tell you, I think this was a well-conducted prospective trial. And again, that's why I mentioned that there was a phase 2 study with letrozole showing the same response rate. So although the letrozole study was small, the data were very consistent with the data of anastrozole in combination with trastuzumab.
You know, when John Mackey presented this data at San Antonio, a couple of docs in practice jumped up to the microphone and sort of jumped on him and said, you know, what about the old palliative model of metastatic disease? Suppose the patient's not really that symptomatic. How do you respond to that?
I tell you, in that situation, we really need to sit down and talk to the patient, because their toxicity is associated with any therapy we recommend. If a patient is asymptomatic, the patient has one or two bone lesions, then I think an aromatase inhibitor could be appropriate therapy with close follow-up. But for the majority of patients with HER2-positive breast cancer, I believe, based on the data, that chemotherapy in combination with trastuzumab should be our first option. But then comes, you know, what chemotherapy, what should be the duration of the chemotherapy concurrent with trastuzumab? And the approach we have taken is that we've used the TCH regimen as our standard, you know, the weekly paclitaxel, carboplatin, trastuzumab. But there are other regimens out there, you know, TCH using docetaxel, new data becoming available, potentially using the nanoparticle albumin-bound paclitaxel in combination with carboplatin and trastuzumab. Certainly the data from vinorelbine are still very intriguing, although the median time to progression tends not to be as good with vinorelbine trastuzumab compared to a taxane in combination with trastuzumab.
As long as you mention that, can you talk a little bit about the study you're doing looking at vinorelbine with capecitabine and trastuzumab?
Now, we know each individual chemotherapy drug, vinorelbine and capecitabine, have activity in the setting of refractory breast cancer or even upfront breast cancer. Preclinically, really both drugs work with trastuzumab. There were some initial data that people were confused about the potential interaction of capecitabine with trastuzumab, but now the very elegant data from a group in China showing very nice response rates of the combination. So we also know that the combination of capecitabine and vinorelbine, it can be very well tolerated with good responses. So we took
the non-alopecia regimen.
That is right, exactly. A good quality of life, no alopecia. So we decided at NCCTG to combine all of this data and create a regimen of triple drugs, capecitabine, vinorelbine, and trastuzumab, in patients who had been pretreated with taxane trastuzumab regimens or as first line. So we're not requiring prior taxane therapy. The accrual is going very well. We've almost completed accrual to this study, and so far the tolerability is excellent.
Do you utilize the vinorelbine capecitabine combination in HER2 negative tumors?
Yes, sometimes we do, yes, because it has good activity and a very good tolerability profile.
Are you thinking of, you know, this maybe moving into the adjuvant setting?
I think that's a very good regimen to consider. Very good. The challenge with that situation has been that vinorelbine has never received a regulatory approval in the United States. So it's very difficult to make decisions about where to place this drug for breast cancer. Vinorelbine has received approval in Europe, but not in the U.S. So in terms of thinking of adjuvant studies, the regulatory pathway is rather difficult.
It's interesting. The reason I was thinking about it is there's a lot of interest in the question of the older patient, the frail patient, the patient that you might not want to give a taxane to for whatever reason, and whether you can just use trastuzumab without chemotherapy or maybe some type of better tolerated regimen.
You're thinking absolutely the correct way. Talking about trastuzumab alone, certainly in the adjuvant setting, I will be very concerned about that approach, because We know, based on the 3 studies that have been done of trastuzumab as single agent for patients with HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer, that the response rate range from about 23% to 30%. These are the 2 studies by Jose Baselga, the study by Chuck Vogel. Whereas if we give trastuzumab in combination with chemotherapy, you know, we get responses 60-80%. So in the adjuvant setting, we really need to maximize the therapy for our patients. So if I'm going to submit a patient to a year of trastuzumab, we need to optimize the use of trastuzumab by using some chemotherapy.
Because so I know 85-year-old woman, 90, I mean, there's a number at which you really start to get concerned about chemo. And you would think that maybe some of these women could tolerate trastuzumab. Is that something you ever do?
You know, not, because if I think a patient is 90 years old and the patient is going to have a median life expectancy of 2 years, then we need to really think the use of any adjuvant therapy, even trastuzumab. But if I feel the patient has a life expectancy that is beyond 5 years, that's when we should, if we're going to use adjuvant therapy, try to use the best we can. Certainly, there are patients who are frail, so we need to continue modulating the type of chemotherapy we use.
Side note, we just had a case presented at an ASCO GI satellite where we had a bunch of investigators, a doc from the audience, presented a 92-year-old patient in perfectly good health, and the panel said, oh, yeah, give him FOLFOX for stage 3. Well, and, they're not as used to playing with the numbers and adjuvant and what it means. But, I mean, do you think, it sounds like your thoughts in the patient, the late octogenarian and beyond, may be a little different.
Yeah, I mean, we need to think of life expectancy more than just the age of the patient. My father was diagnosed with stage 3 colon cancer at age 79. And we treated him actually with 5-FU-leucovorin as adjuvant therapy. And this was 5 years ago. He didn't have any toxicity whatsoever of the regimen.
And he wanted it.
That's right. He wanted it.
And it worked.
And it worked. Very nicely.
He got through it.
He actually cooked every day after he finished his chemotherapy. So it was great. Great story. And he feels absolutely fine right now. In the setting that we're talking about the optimal chemotherapy to use with trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting, we still need to do a lot of work in this area. First of all, the value of anthracyclines, the potential of using other agents that we have not received approval in the U.S. for with trastuzumab, because the only regimen currently approved is the anthracycline taxane regimen based on B31 and N9831. But we certainly know the data from HERA. We know the data from the BCRG study. We know the data from FinHER.
Well, let's talk about the data from the BCRG that just got presented in December, because that really is something that's given people a lot of things to think about. So can you talk about what your take was in terms of what the key points were from the BCRG, track it out a little bit in terms of what happened previously, and what do you think it means right now?
Yeah, the 006 was a very elegant study, good concepts to take into the clinical trial, good accrual. These data San Antonio were based not a final analysis, but it was a second interim analysis. And that's something that we need to remember, because some of the data changed from last year to this year. So we need to wait for the follow-up to have some more conclusive data.
Now, is that really true? I've heard people say that. I've heard other people say, yeah, but it's not going to change in terms of the statistical whatever. Do you know what the actual answer is?
I can only say that in this presentation, it said second interim analysis, not final analysis. So I think we need to be judicious with that and wait. And actually, this happens not only in the setting of 006, but I think in the setting of all of the adjuvant trastuzumab trials, because the median follow-up has been in the range of 3 years. And breast cancer is a long history in terms of lives of patients. So we need to look at data 5 years, look at not only disease-free survival, but tolerability issues. Certainly, because the data have been so good with such short follow-up, we think we have an answer. But I think we have a short-term answer to the many questions we have.
So can you summarize what the key points were that came out of the 006 paper and what you think? It sounds like you're kind of still thinking about it.
Yeah, well, the TCH regimen, as tested, is an alternative to the AC followed by taxane trastuzumab. We cannot say that TCH is a better regimen by any means. It is an alternative. Statistically speaking, there are no differences between ACTH and the TCH regimen as reported. There's a little bit of a caveat in the numbers that might be of interest. If one looks at the number of cases with congestive heart failure between TCH and ACTH, for the ACTH patients, there are 16 additional cases of CHF that have occurred. If one looks at the number of breast cancer events, including breast cancer relapse and death, there are 12 additional cases in the TCH regimen compared to ACTH. So if we look at numbers of patients per se, in TCH, there are 16 fewer CHF cases, but there are 12 more breast cancer recurrences or deaths. So it's something that I think we need to pay close attention to and be careful. And based on all of this data and the follow-up time, the number of events, I think the story of 006 is a good story that deserves follow-up.
So right now, you see a patient with a node-positive tumor, otherwise healthy. Generally speaking, what chemo regimen are you going to use?
We use ACTH as our standard approach. Actually, we use the regimen approved by the FDA. However, there are some additional things we're doing these days, and we're considering them quite seriously in our practice. And it is the utilization of ACE inhibitors to potentially decrease risk of cardiac toxicity, both associated with anthracyclines and potentially trastuzumab. This is something that we did not incorporate in any of the clinical trials that we conducted, because as medical oncologists, I don't think we've been as attuned to the potential value of ACE inhibitors to improve cardiovascular mortality in the setting of other illnesses such as hypertension or underlying cardiac disease.
Why would you think that the ACE inhibitors would be helpful, sort of mechanism of action-wise?
Reduction of the load of the heart, after load reduction of the heart, which may have implications.
So you're saying you would start it up front?
Well, now we have data, at least some data from a European investigator, saying that ACE inhibitors may decrease the risk of anthracycline-related cardiac toxicity. So that's one aspect. Number two, we feel that we need to address this issue of the use of ACE inhibitors. So we are proposing a trial right now to be conducted within our Mayo Consortium or the intergroup. We're having discussions to exactly do this. Treat patients with ACTH and do a randomized double-blind study looking at ACE inhibitor versus no ACE inhibitor with the endpoint of looking at changes of LVEF, because certainly the number of cases of congestive heart failure is extremely small. For us to be able to look at differences in the adjuvant trials, we've had to enroll more than 3,500 patients essentially per study. So in small pilot studies, we're going to be looking at changes in LVEF. But I think this is a strategy really worthy of investigation, and we're going to pursue it very vigorously in the next few months. So the setting of ACE inhibitors is either if a patient has a decreased ejection fraction while receiving AC trastuzumab, should the patient then receive an ACE inhibitor instead of stopping the trastuzumab? That's one option. And number two, can we look at ACE inhibitors up front for the potential that they may prevent decreases of ejection fraction associated with these drugs?
Underlying all this, though, I hear you saying that you're not as confident that TCH has as much anti-tumor activity as an anthracycline taxane.
I'm a little concerned about that. You know, statistically, there are no differences, and I must follow statistics. But right now, the three-year disease-free survival is 87% for ACTH, 86% for TCH. I mean, these numbers are not different statistically speaking. But I view the data from TCH as very promising. Again, it's an alternative if physicians have particular concerns about anthracyclines. However, one area that leads to my concern is that patients who have underlying cardiac dysfunction are automatically being considered to receive TCH. And we just don't have any data there because in the BCRG006 study, essentially patients older than 70 were excluded. And remember, in our trial, N9831, the risks associated with trastuzumab cardiac toxicity were older age and hypertension. So that's why we need to be very careful with doing cross-study comparisons. And again, the age of the patients in the BCRG study is another issue that we just need to think about. I'm not saying that TCH is a bad regimen. You know, we've published on TCH over the years. I think it's a great regimen. In the adjuvant setting before, I would consider it as standard. I believe that we need some more follow-up.
And it's interesting now with clinical research on HER2 positives, like everything seems to like change every week. So tell me, it's only been a few weeks since I heard from John Mackey and the NSABP that they were going to move forward with TCH plus or minus bevacizumab as their next trial. Is that still the case?
Correct. But in that trial, there will be a group of patients receiving ACTH. So ACTH will be allowed, as far as I'm aware, and this was as of last week, as part of that trial.
It will be allowed.
Allowed. So the trial, as I understand, will be powered to look at the potential benefit of bevacizumab in the context of TCH, but there will be a subset of patients who will be receiving ACTH as the backbone for treatment.
So people have that option.
That is right. And that is essentially consistent with what I think should be standards of care right now. as we await more maturity of the adjuvant trials that have been already completed in terms of accrual.
A couple quick questions about management of patients in a non-protocol setting. One of the things I'm sure you hear a lot of questions about is a patient with node-negative disease. How do you approach particularly patients with smaller tumors?
In the clinical trials, as we all may recall, the majority of patients had tumors that were greater than 1 centimeter. They were very scattered patients who had tumors smaller than 1 centimeter. So we lack solid data related to the absolute improvement by adding trastuzumab in that setting. However, there were two very intriguing presentations at the San Antonio meeting which addressed the natural history of small HER2-positive breast cancers, demonstrating that these patients appear to have poor prognosis. So my interpretation of the data is that HER2 is really the driver of prognosis more than just the tumor size. So I'm tending to be more open, if I may say, to discuss the potential of using adjuvant trastuzumab for patients with small breast cancers, although I am clearly discussing that the eligibility criteria of the studies it did not include them. But we're actually making that recommendation, certainly outside of the FDA boundaries, because as you know, up till now, the FDA has only approved adjuvant trastuzumab for patients with node-positive breast cancer. And that is something I understand based on the data from the joint analysis, because we only had about 6% total patients with node-negative disease. But as practicing oncologists, we know the data from the other studies that enrolled such a large number of patients with node-negative disease, demonstrating a benefit of adding trastuzumab. So I have zero caveats related to the recommendation of using adjuvant trastuzumab, irrespective of nodal status. But again, for patients with very small tumors, I wish we had more data. We don't. But recurrent breast cancer, it's not good. And I prefer to over-treat, if I may say that, under-treat, because under-treatment may lead to patient death.
I guess the other thing is, even though we don't have the data, we do have a long history in adjuvant therapy of breast cancer, the concept of relative risk reduction. And, you know, whether that always will apply or we don't know, but I guess it looks like it applies, and I guess it looks like it applies with HER2-positive tumors and trastuzumab, or do you think it does?
It does. I completely agree. The relative benefits appear to be the same irrespective of the subgroup we've looked at. So the matter at hand will be to really understand the natural history of small HER2-positive breast cancers, where the HER2 testing has been done the correct way, let's put it like that. Based on the data available, not only from these presentations at San Antonio, but also a very elegant manuscript published by Steve Chia in JCO, it was in April of about 2004, 2005, demonstrating that patients with small tumors, even smaller than 1 centimeter, but whose tumors are grade 3, have a 10-year relapse that appears to exceed 25%. That is the figure I'm giving patients, a relapse rate of about 25% at 5 to 10 years. And based on all of the information we have, that kind of relapse warrants systemic adjuvant therapy.
The woman with the HER2-positive tumor says, suppose I just take hormonal therapy, how's that going to affect that 25%?
In that case, now that we have more data with hormonal therapy, it's even worse than I thought 6 months ago. Because before we could have said hormonal therapy may decrease the recurrence rate by 30%, but now it may be by 10%, it may be 5%. Those data certainly are not available. So I'm less confident using hormonal therapy alone for those patients today than I was 6 months ago.
We talked about the NSABP/BCRG discussions about a trial. I'm curious what your thoughts are about that strategy of looking at Bev in the adjuvant setting and HER2-positive tumors along with trastuzumab chemotherapy.
I think as we developed adjuvant trials with a global sense of breast cancer, it's important to look at more than one target to optimize therapy. And it's important for different groups to look at different strategies so that we have faster answers for our patients. Antiangiogenesis is a very important strategy in the management of many malignancies, including breast cancer. Certainly the data from E2100 are fascinating, in which there was a clear demonstration of improvement in response rate and progression-free survival when bevacizumab was added to weekly paclitaxel compared to weekly paclitaxel alone. You know, the issue of impacting survival is something that has raised many questions. But now the Ribbon-1 trial is completing accrual, and this trial is looking at chemotherapy plus minus bevacizumab. The Ribbon-2 trial is accruing patients well, and this is the trial looking at patients who have already had chemotherapy develop progressive disease, and they're being randomized to chemotherapy alone versus chemotherapy plus bevacizumab. And I hope that we'll be able to launch Ribbon 3 trial, which will be for patients who receive upfront chemotherapy bevacizumab, for there to be a randomization of chemotherapy alone versus chemotherapy and continuation of bevacizumab, a question that we have had for a long time with trastuzumab. So there's a lot of interest.
Is that going to happen?
I hope so. We've had discussions about this over
the
last several months.
About that in, you know, colon and lung, right. And nobody seems to be able to do it.
That's right.
Any guesses as to what we'll see? I mean, one of the things that, and this kind of came out of the trastuzumab experience, is if, can you select people who you ought to continue? Like maybe people who are responding better, or any thoughts about that?
Tell you, right now, we don't even know exactly where bevacizumab fits in the context of breast cancer. So I'm awaiting, you know, the data from the Ribbon trial, the data from the Avaro trial being conducted in Europe, will also be very telling, because in that trial is docetaxel alone, docetaxel with two different doses of bevacizumab, as it was done in the lung cancer study. So we need to wait a little bit more. Certainly the FDA needs to look at the data very carefully, but I look forward to the data solidifying what we believe theoretically should work, which is antiangiogenesis therapy in the setting of breast cancer. So based on this, I think it's good to start thinking about adjuvant trials today. I don't think we should wait 2 years to develop a trial. Whether the safety data that currently exists using combination trastuzumab and bevacizumab are enough to move to an adjuvant trial tomorrow is a different story. But over the next few months, this data will become available and we will all feel more comfortable.
What were your thoughts about the data that's coming out looking at the combination of trastuzumab and bevacizumab? There was more data presented at San Antonio. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that was a very nice study led by the UCLA group. There are certain issues related to this study. These patients had low tumor burden. These were not patients that had received multiple prior chemotherapy regimens. So it was a pretty interesting subset of patients with breast cancer. The data are very early. They're promising. But we need more robust data, both in terms of safety and also efficacy.
And when you think about the biology of HER2-positive tumors and the biology of what these two agents do, does it make sense to you that they might be synergistic?
Yeah, well, in clinical models, they are synergistic. Not only trastuzumab with bevacizumab, but trastuzumab with any of the other antiangiogenesis agents, even the small molecule inhibitors.
Of course, us in the non-preclinical world are always totally skeptical when we hear about those things. It's so hard to judge. I mean, is it really dramatic? Does it? You know, we can't separate the hype from the reality.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I used to run a laboratory for many years, and I decided that other people could be curing mice, that I would take care of patients.
It seems like it's worked so far.
But it's good to at least have some rationale before we can move to clinical trials. The issue with HER2-positive breast cancer is that this tends to be an aggressive disease. So if we use trastuzumab in combination with bevacizumab, you know, we may not see actually huge responses to begin with, because antiangiogenesis drugs may be kind of longer-term drugs. You know, when we use them as single agents, they don't work very well. But in combination, that's where they may fit in.
And when you think about some of the mechanisms that have been speculated since we started to observe this synergy between Bev and chemotherapy, and you hear about the normalization of the blood supply and better access of chemotherapy or less tissue pressure, how do you think that would play out with trastuzumab as opposed to chemotherapy?
Well, I hope it will work well. Trastuzumab is a much larger molecule, you know, than the chemotherapy drugs that we use. So in terms of feasibility, it's hard to know. But I think, you know, trastuzumab, based on the data that we have, seems to make everything work better. It makes the hormones look better. Combine trastuzumab with any chemotherapy drug, and the chemotherapy drug looks better. The responses are very nice. So hopefully it'll work the same in combination with bevacizumab, because as you know, bevacizumab alone doesn't have a great activity in the setting of breast cancer.
Let's talk about what they call the trial formerly known as Aphrodite, and now it's ALTO, is
ALTO,
that right?
That is right, ALTTO.
What does that stand for?
It's the Adjuvant Lapatinib and Trastuzumab Trial Organization.
Who is actually involved in the organization and running of this study, and where is it right now?
Yeah, this is a global study, and it's been developed as a collaborative effort between essentially Martine Piccart and me and our respective groups. So she's the representative for BIG. I'm the representative for NCCDG and the North American Breast Intergroup. So we're co-PIs of this study. The study has been in development now for more than a year.
I remember talking to you about this whole concept. It seemed like it was 2-3 years ago.
Oh, my gosh. It hurts to think about this. Actually, yeah, we proposed it more than 2 years ago.
I mean, you told me about this before the adjuvant trastuzumab trials were even reported.
Very good.
Do you remember
Neil.
That?
Good memory, Neil.
Yeah, you were talking about lapatinib. There was no lapatinib data out there. And you told me the design. It's not much different than what it is today.
Actually, we proposed this more than 2 years ago. You know, it is absolutely the truth. But we had to work through review after review after review. People wanted to wait for more data to become available. Then a decision was made that we should have one global study instead of having independent studies in Europe and the United States. So we elected to be good colleagues and spent hundreds of hours to try to harmonize the systems. And that's why the trial has not been initiated. It has been a challenge to have a global study.
So what is the current trial design?
Yeah, it
and
is.
And eligibility.
Yes. We have, for eligibility, HER2 testing locally, but it will be corroborated centrally.
FISH?
No. Immunohistochemistry. FISH may be utilized in some cases, but we'll use what we use in our practice, immunohistochemistry or FISH. Then the patients will receive anthracycline-based regimen, and we have a panel of different anthracycline regimens that may be used. Eligibility also will be based on a tumor size greater than 1 centimeter. So after the patient receives the anthracycline, then we do an ejection fraction. If the ejection fraction is 50% or greater, then the patient is randomized. So it's a different strategy than we used for the North American studies before.
I can feel Dennis Lehman's blood pressure rising.
Yeah, he's probably going to feel very good because we're not going to include anthracycline as part of the treatment per se. And now that we've learned so much about the safety of anthracyclines in the adjuvant setting, because there has been another misconception about that, in that people think that somehow 5 to 7% of patients who get anthracycline cannot receive trastuzumab, and there are no data to justify such statement. You know, even in our trial, in N9831, what really happened is that of the patients who received 4 cycles of AC, there were 5% of patients who did not meet criteria to go on to trastuzumab the way we defined eligibility in the study. But really what happened is that 2.5% of patients developed an ejection fraction that dropped below the lower limit of normal. So the ejection fraction may have dropped to 48 or 49. And then in the other 2.5%, the ejection fraction dropped more than 15% at one point within the normal range.
And I guess that has now been rethought. I mean, do you think at this point, if it's still in the normal range, that a drop of greater than 15 has the same meaning that you thought when that was first set up?
If it's within normal, we feel the patient should receive trastuzumab.
So that's a change.
That is a change. And the other change is that in N9831, and actually also in B31, if the patient developed a one-time decrease of ejection fraction after AC, we did not repeat the ejection fraction. And this is something we would really modify now. If a patient has AC, get an ejection fraction. If ejection fraction is low, then you can either do two things. You can wait 3 or 4 weeks, repeat the ejection fraction, or you could even consider doing an ACE inhibitor and then repeating the ejection fraction and allow the patient to receive this potentially life-saving therapy.
So they sort of get the anthracycline stress test and then they get randomized.
You can use that term. Again, we're going to have a variety of anthracycline regimens that will be allowed.
But certainly no TCH, non-anthracycline is not going to be in it.
No, TCH is not going to be part of the ALTO trial for now, and I'll give you the reasons. One of the reasons is that we don't have any safety data of TCH with lapatinib, or we don't really have good safety data of docetaxel with lapatinib. And there may be a potential for drug interactions here, so we must be very careful. However, we're giving this a lot of thought. Studies in the metastatic setting are ongoing, and when we have safety data, then we will relook at this issue. We're not going to be blind to new data.
So at this point, though, they get randomized, and what's the randomization?
Okay, four-arm randomization. What we're going to do is we're going to use weekly paclitaxel as the chemotherapy, as we used in N9831. Then the patients receive either 1 year of trastuzumab, which is standard. The second arm will be 1 year of lapatinib. A third arm is a sequential arm of trastuzumab for 3 months, followed by a little bit of a break of 6 weeks, then moving to lapatinib. And then the fourth arm is a concurrent trastuzumab-lapatinib combination. This is the randomization that will be given to most patients around the world. However, the study has another potential option. And it is that let's say a patient is seen by a physician who does not think the patient should receive a taxane. In that setting, then the patient can receive the anthracycline. Then the patient can be randomized to the anti-HER2 therapy alone without a taxane.
Without any chemo?
Without any chemotherapy. Remember, they would have received the anthracycline up front. However, we are doing this to be open-minded. However, I feel that this very small minority of patients will be assigned to that arm.
I don't think people do that much.
I know they don't that, especially in the U.S.
In our patterns of care studies, the U.S., they don't do that.
And I would never recommend that a patient with HER2-positive breast cancer doesn't get a taxane as part of their treatment. But we're trying to be encompassing. Again, this is a worldwide approach. So we're going to see how things go.
What I like to ask people when I talk about this trial design, because of the fact that one of the arms does not have any trastuzumab, mm-hmm. is, are they comfortable putting a patient with 5 or 10 positive nodes on the study? Are you?
I am. I mean, we've been thinking about this for years. The data with trastuzumab are certainly impressive. At the same time, we are not curing everybody. And there's a small risk of cardiotoxicity, although it's very manageable and not something that would prevent me from using trastuzumab practically in any patient who has a normal ejection fraction. However, it's good to look at options. The mechanisms of resistance of lapatinib may be different than those of trastuzumab. Lapatinib, at least based on all of the studies that have been reported so far, appears to have very good activity in the setting of breast cancer, more than just preclinical activity. Now we have good clinical studies demonstrating this.
When you look at sort of indirect comparisons of trials in metastatic disease, is it kind of looking the same ballpark as trastuzumab, better or not quite as good?
It looks in the same ballpark in small phase 2 studies. There are no head-to-head comparisons right now of trastuzumab with lapatinib in the metastatic setting, although trials are being planned in which patients would receive upfront taxane with trastuzumab or upfront taxane with lapatinib, and I really look forward to that.
What about trastuzumab and lapatinib, that combination? What do we know about that in terms of safety, anything, efficacy?
I'm very excited about this potential combination because I think targeting the HER2 pathway in a dual mode may give us the answer that we're looking for.
But what have we seen so far?
We're looking at safety. Certainly the studies that have been done so far look very safe, combining trastuzumab
what
and lapatinib.
What studies have been done?
There are studies ongoing in the metastatic setting, and also studies of paclitaxel in combination with trastuzumab and lapatinib.
And what's seen in terms of both safety and efficacy?
I can only comment on safety because the reports officially have not come out, but we've taken those into consideration and actually submitted the data to the NCI and the FDA for their review of this protocol. We at the Mayo Cancer Research Consortium are starting a trial next week, which is a pilot cardiac safety study as adjuvant for HER2-positive breast cancer. And what we're going to do is exactly what we're doing on ARM4 of ALTO. Here, patients will get AC given either every 2 weeks or every 3 weeks, followed by what we call THL, weekly paclitaxel, trastuzumab, lapatinib for 3 months, then trastuzumab, lapatinib for the rest of the year. So what we're doing is what we did in N9831, but adding lapatinib to all the areas where we use trastuzumab. And the reason for that trial, it's not that we don't have already safety data related to that combination. What we're doing is a very sophisticated and careful review of potential markers that may help us understand cardiac safety. So we're doing a lot of serum markers. We're doing specifically something called metabolomics, looking at 500 metabolites of carbohydrates, lipids, and proteins, because we want to understand this cardiac safety. I tell you, there were some fascinating data presented at San Antonio in a preclinical model discussing the differential effects of trastuzumab and lapatinib in terms of proteins in the cells that may help understand the cardiac safety of these drugs. But right now, the cardiac safety of lapatinib looks very good. You know, we just are finishing writing a paper.
Does it look very good mean it looks like there's not excess cardiac toxicity, or do we really have the data to know one way or the other?
We have the data. You know, I've looked, not only I have looked, but my colleague in this study is Michael Ewer from MD Anderson. We've looked at the data of more than 3,500 patients who have received lapatinib for a variety of tumor types. In about 2,200 of those patients, they had not received prior trastuzumab. The incidence of symptomatic congestive heart failure is in the range of 0.2 to 0.3%.
And what about in people who had anthracyclines before?
No difference at all in terms of the risk of cardiotoxicity in the lapatinib trial, still 0.2 to 0.3% congestive heart failure. So
I don't even want to begin to think about the mechanism of why it wouldn't cause cardiac toxicity and trastuzumab would. Any guesses?
Well, that's why these data presented at San Antonio are very interesting, because it may be a pathway associated with TNF-alpha that we're going to be exploring some more in preclinical and also in clinical specimens. So related to that single arm in the study, you know, this is something we did not take lightly. We want to figure out whether, you know, there could be an alternative to trastuzumab, but we need to test it. You know, in many parts of the country, taking tablets may be very advantageous for patients. If indeed there is a difference in cardiac toxicity, the only way to really figure this out is by doing a randomized trial, because just looking at the lapatinib studies alone or the trastuzumab alone doesn't do enough service to us understanding this potentially important factor. But can you imagine if in this trial we show that lapatinib is equivalent to trastuzumab, but even less cardiac toxicity? However, we need to be a little careful. I'm not saying that people should be using lapatinib now in the adjuvant setting. I would never do this, at least for now, unless we do this as part of a trial. The toxicity profile of lapatinib is different. You know, there's some GI toxicities that do not occur with trastuzumab. So there are pluses and minuses to both drugs.
How much GI toxicity?
It depends on the drug or lapatinib that is used. I expect that in the dose that we're going to utilize in ALTO, the risk is going to be no more than 5%.
This is nausea?
And diarrhea.
Nausea and diarrhea.
That is right, yeah. So lapatinib looks like a very good drug. It's a tablet. The cardiac toxicity looks very good, but there are other some safety issues that we need to pay attention to. Another issue is that we have a proposed dose of lapatinib, but we need to be sure that patients will take the drugs, because we can have this great theoretical idea, and if people take only two tablets instead of five or six, then we may not be able to really explore the efficacy of this agent.
If lapatinib were approved and available, what would you be using as first-line therapy of metastatic disease in a patient who never got trastuzumab?
I would certainly use our TCH regimen, weekly paclitaxel, carboplatin, trastuzumab.
What about the patient who's had prior trastuzumab?
In this setting, I mean, that is another fascinating idea, because the FDA approval of lapatinib will be combination capecitabine and lapatinib after AT and trastuzumab. However, in practice, we clearly know that we've continued trastuzumab beyond progression. So another trial, Neil, that we're proposing, and I hope to get support from many colleagues, is to do a practical study in a patient who has received trastuzumab-containing regimen who develops progressive disease. Strategies could be an all-oral regimen, capecitabine in combination with lapatinib, or an all-IV regimen that is very well tolerated, vinorelbine trastuzumab. That trial will give us the answer that we're looking for.
But I guess one big issue there would be the time since completion of the adjuvant trastuzumab. How would you sort of factor that in?
I would allow any patient, irrespective of when they develop the progression, because what I want to do is a study that is practical in terms of practice. And this is
right.
The question that we all have as right. Clinicians. Should we move to lapatinib or can we continue trastuzumab? So I look forward to generating this study in the next few months.
I was just thinking, you know how we have these day-long think tanks in breast cancer? You've been involved
with
this.
That's right.
I think I should do a day-long think tank just with you. I mean, like, we're almost done. We haven't all these hormone things. We haven't had a chance to talk about. But anyhow, well, let me just ask you one more thing, which is when you were talking about the taxane, just kind of popped when in the trials and the ALTO trial. As the breast cancer merry-go-round, particularly with HER2, increases in speed faster and faster and things kind of jump on and jump off, where do you think nab-paclitaxel is going to fit in?
Very exciting drugs. I just wish it was less expensive, because the data of nab-paclitaxel versus once every 3 week paclitaxel justified the FDA approval. Now there are some very tantalizing data on the randomized phase 2 looking at the nab-paclitaxel or docetaxel once every 3 weeks. I mean, we have to be interested, nothing proven definitely because it was a randomized phase 2 and the study still continues. But I'm very happy that there will be a formal randomized phase 3 of nanoparticle albumin-bound paclitaxel weekly versus docetaxel once every 3 weeks.
What about the issue of NAB in the HER2-positive patient with trastuzumab? What do we know about that and where do you think that's heading?
Yeah, there's clear activity. Small phase 2 study was done. There's an ongoing phase 2 study of looking at nanoparticle albumin-bound paclitaxel, carbo, and trastuzumab. We're waiting. The group at Memorial is doing this study, so we look at the data. You know, the benefit of this drug is that it doesn't require premedications. So even if the nab-paclitaxel was similar in efficacy to paclitaxel, I would tend to favor that new drug because of the lack of premedications and the potential impact on the quality of life of my patients.
You mentioned the study that was presented at San Antonio by Bill Gradishar comparing NAB to docetaxel. Can you talk about sort of what that looked at and what your take was from it?
Yeah, this was about a 300-patient randomized phase 2 study. There were four arms. In three of the arms, the patients received the nanoparticle albumin-bound paclitaxel. The fourth arm was docetaxel. The three arms of the NAB paclitaxel were 300 per meter squared once every 3 weeks, and two weekly regimens, either 100 or 150 per meter squared, 3 weeks out of four. The docetaxel arm was 100 per meter squared of docetaxel once every 3 weeks. Bill and colleagues looked at, they did some actually comparisons amongst the arms, but there were about 70 patients per arm. Well, what they presented were response data, and they were fascinating because the response rate for the once every 3 weeks nanoparticle albumin-bound paclitaxel was 33%. The response rate for the once every 3 week docetaxel was 36%, which is what I would expect from single agent taxane in the first line setting of metastatic disease. But the responses for the two weekly nanoparticle albumin-bound preparation arms were about 58 and 62%. I mean, beautiful responses for these weekly regimens. And that's why investigators will take the 100 per meter square weekly as the appropriate comparator to go against docetaxel for the phase 3 study. So I tell you, this randomized phase 2 study was very telling because it was not only that they looked at the response rate. The progression-free survival is still early, although the numbers are starting to look interesting, but the tolerability was also very good for the weekly and now paclitaxel 100 per meter squared, 3 weeks out of four. So good study.
You mentioned the economic issues. What specifically is it? Is it the issue of reimbursement, the cost of the patient, or cost to society that's concerning you?
Well, it's the cost of society. We need to look at the benefit that is being obtained with new drugs compared to older drugs. So let me give you an example. In the setting of trastuzumab, we could justify the expense clearly because we're decreasing recurrence by 52%, improving survival by 33%. But when you have two agents and the new agents, it's a little bit better, then it's hard to justify spending 10 more times the cost. You see, so we need to be very careful with how much we can charge based on the benefit that we can obtain with the newer drugs.